The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
It is official. Queen Elizabeth II, the UK's longest serving monarch, has died. The monarch that has served for more than 70 years, longer than 85% of the population, has been alive in the United Kingdom. 15 prime ministers, the first being Winston Churchill, a woman who lived through World War II, and 14 US presidents over her lifetime.
New COVID outbreaks in China have forced 65 million people back into lockdown.
This week's lockdowns and partial lockdowns cover 33 cities and 65 million people across a huge swath of China, from the city of Daqing, an oil-producing area near the border with Russia, to the tech hub of Shenzhen in the south. In Chengdu, the capital of Sichuan province, a major metropolis, was brought to a standstill after just a few hundred cases. But Beijing argues it has no choice but to double down.
We're seeing geopolitics being reshaped in real time right now, because basically Russia's integration with the West is over. The door has been slammed. Putin has thrown away 22 years of economic integration, and basically Russia ends up an economic dependency of China. Obviously, Iran, you know, they're comparing notes on how do you deal with sanctions, and Russia's buying drones right now from Iran.
European gas prices again reached near record highs on Monday. EU countries are digesting the implications of Russia's decision to switch off flows down the Nord Stream 1 pipeline to Germany. European stocks dropped at the start of the week, and the euro has been trading at its lowest value against the dollar for two decades. Germany's Chancellor Scholz insists his country can make it through the winter without Russian gas, but Europe will need to reorganise its energy supplies.
Well, you're right. We're in real trouble on this. Our energy policy has been a disaster for 20 years. We thought if we built lots of windmills, put the prices up of electricity, transferred big subsidy from ordinary folk to big business, our lives would be sorted. Wind energy is great until the wind doesn't blow. Then you need gas. And we've not been producing our own gas, not been producing our own coal, not enough oil. We are not energy independent. So we are in a terrible mess. Vladimir Putin is partly to blame, but the other 50% is very, very bad energy policy.
The state just agreed to keep its only nuclear power plant open for a little bit longer, which is good news. But here's my question to you. How in the hell did we get to a point where people actually considered shutting off the only reliable thing that was 10% of the state's daily energy supply? It's mind-blowing.
You know, it's become a bit of a religion out here in California. You know, people got a very apocalyptic worldview around nuclear starting in the 60s. It was the last nuclear plant that we still are operating, Diablo Canyon, was actually supported by the Sierra Club. The turn against it was really because people didn't want to have enough energy to support a growing population. And that continues to be the reason that we don't allow desalination plants that we desperately need. It's the reason why they don't create enough water storage facilities and why we have water shortages. So there's just a kind of, for lack of a better word, I guess just an anti-human, anti-civilization, very romantic worldview. So we've been shutting down natural gas power plants as well. And now they're burning diesel and kerosene to keep the lights on. It's a really serious situation.
California also has to buy power from other states in order to meet sometimes peak load, does it not? And the risk there, and I don't think people realize how close this came. If Arizona or Nevada decides they don't want to sell California any more power because they need it all for themselves, the lights, the heat, and the air conditioning are going off.
Well, yeah, not that, but we pay the most for electricity than any other state except for Hawaii. We've had the most expensive gasoline prices, and we also pay the highest taxes. So certainly it's not for lack of money. In some ways, it's because we've been spending so much trying to move to renewables, and we're just experiencing the limits of trying to rely on what are fundamentally unreliable, weather-dependent energy sources.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Well, the stock market entered a three-week losing streak, with all the major indexes ending up on the plus side for the week as oil prices bounced back on Friday. As the price of energy and electricity skyrocketed in Europe, governments in Europe moved to cap electricity and gas prices through intervention, price caps, and new transfer taxes in a futile attempt to manage higher prices caused by bad policies. Meanwhile, more Fed governors came out this week in support of a significant increase in interest rates this month. It's widely expected. The Fed will raise the Fed funds rate another 75 basis points, taking the Fed funds rate to 3%, something we have not seen in over 15 years, as we see more evidence of an economy that is or soon heading into a recession. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to the Financial Sense NewsHour. This week's program is all about rising energy prices, beginning with Robin Griffiths, who's very bullish on energy and commodities. Robert Rapier will follow Robin as we discuss long and short-term prospects for oil and the opportunities for investing in the energy patch. Finally, Chris Sheridan and myself will discuss how bad policies are leading and broadening the energy crisis. But first, let's go to Ryan Poplava to find out the major stories moving the markets this week. Ryan?
This week was about investors taking their cues from technical support levels and bearish sentiment in stocks that helped set the stage for a rally. There seems to be a growing acceptance towards a restrictive Fed, evident when stocks closed higher after a Wall Street Journal article reported Wednesday that the Fed is likely to raise the Fed funds rate by 75 basis points at its September 20 and 21st FOMC meeting. The Nasdaq ended a seven-day losing streak, and the S&P 500 successfully defended the 3,900 level. And this despite continued hawkish comments from Fed officials this week. Fed Vice Chair Brainard said the policy rate will need to rise further. Cleveland Fed President Mester reiterated herself that rates will need to be taken to a restrictive level and that she does not anticipate a rate cut in 2023. The Fed Chair Powell on Thursday said the Fed is committed to restoring price stability and will keep at its job until the job is done. The ECB raised rates 75 basis points Thursday in what is termed front-loading, a transition from highly accommodative policy stance to help return the ECB towards its 2% inflationary target. Despite the aggressive hike, and in addition to the comments from Powell and the low unemployment numbers, fueling some early selling, bulls were able to continue to defend some key levels I mentioned, which encouraged short covering and new positions to enter, which closed the S&P 500 above 4,000. And this momentum carried forward into Friday's trading. Other important items this week was the back and forth between Europe and the U.S. trying to rally together to enforce price controls on Russian oil. While Putin fired back, they won't honor any contracts where there are price controls. The U.S. Treasury pleaded with countries to join the price cap Friday, but China rejected it, South Korea ignored it, and India's reply was somewhat terse. Why don't you, America, make it so we can buy oil from Venezuela and Iran, and then we'll talk price caps on Russia. Meanwhile, this week, OPEC cut production 100,000 barrels per day, and last I checked, markets were ignoring these issues, with West Texas Intermediate trading at fresh six-month lows in the mid-$80 range. Francois Trahan of Trahan Macro Research had this to say this week. The good news for the Fed as they head into their September meeting is that lower commodity prices are already weighing on headline inflation. More good news is that goods inflation has been cut nearly in half this year, a sign that supply chain issues are slowly easing. The main thorn in the side of Fed policy at this point remains labor markets. While many were quick to celebrate the August employment report, the reality is that the spread between demand, job openings, and supply, unemployed workers, remains near historic highs. This is a sign of yet higher wage inflation to come, so that implies higher core inflation ahead. So that was Francois Trahan of Trahan Macro Research. Well said. The Consumer Price Index will be announced next Tuesday. Given the weakness in commodity prices and given that the big jumps in the index a year ago will drop off in the monthly report, it's not too far-fetched to imagine we'll see yet another mechanical deceleration of inflation. That might continue to support near-term bullishness that the Fed may be able to begin easing up on a large 75-point hike in meetings to come. The makeup of the rally this week was much better than last week's. Last week's rally was weak, and it was in defensive areas like utilities and healthcare. This week, strength was seen in the cyclical sectors, And we saw a risk-on preference that was also seen in a rally in cryptocurrencies. Up next, our guest technician for the week, Robin Griffiths.
Prices have risen depending on where you are in Europe and exactly what the market is by anywhere between 300% and 1,000%. Coal prices have risen anywhere between 200 to 400%. Electricity prices have risen, you know, anywhere between 200 and 1,000%. What this means is that the shock to consumption of 15% of non-energy goods and services can create an absolutely massive recession. And we're talking about the type of recession that's, you know, the largest recession that Europe has probably experienced since World War II.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we are committed to helping you build, maintain, and preserve your wealth. Contact us today to find out about our comprehensive financial planning and asset management services. Whether you're planning for retirement, taxes, putting together an estate plan, or need assistance in managing a 401k, Financial Sense Wealth Management is here to help. Give us a call to speak with one of our certified financial planners or wealth advisors at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsense.com and hit where it says Contact Us. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, Wall Street is split right now. Half of Wall Street thinks the stock market will head higher and be higher by the end of the year. The other half, not so much. Well, let's find out. Joining us on the program is Robin Griffiths. Robin, let's take it from the top. As you look at the markets, we've had a nice rally, but now we're heading in the opposite direction. What's your take?
From the technical analysis point of view, we're actually in a global bear market. It isn't as bad in America as in plenty of other places. But according to my work, the majority of world markets are making a pattern of falling highs and lows. And that's the first definition of a bear market. And then when they go below their 200-day moving averages, and most of them have done that, that confirms it is a bear market. Now, mostly, though, I mean, since the middle of June, there was a decent rally. I make it the sixth rally of the bear market to date. But the rally was done on a good story, but it was a wrong story. What had happened, roughly speaking, is people had expected the inflation rate in America to be 10% or something really close to that. And then when the figures came out, it was in the 8% odd area. So people thought, aha, we're getting to the end or the peaking of American inflation. This will almost certainly mean that the Fed doesn't have to be so aggressive in future. They can go much easier, and we'll end up with a soft landing. And of course, a lot of other people reasoned in exactly the same way. So in fact, on my list of markets, and I'm following 36 of them quite closely, the only one that didn't rally was Hong Kong. Everybody else had a rally. And in the case of the U.S. market, the S&P 500 rallied more or less 11%, leaving itself still down 10% from its all-time high, so still maintaining the pattern of falling highs and lows. Then what happened is at Jackson Hole, the Fed chairman went along and said, look, guys, I have to talk to you carefully here. What you saw about the inflation was a tiny little bit of water, and it was falling in the correct bucket. But we at the Fed know we need an awful lot more than that before we can change money on monetary policy, because we know from experience, if we go soft on monetary policy too soon, inflation gets out of control and is really, really difficult to get it back under control. So I'm having to tell you, you can forget soft landings. I'm going to have to carry on in more or less Volcker style while I'm able to get away with it. The second bit of my work has to do with correlating monetary policy with the stock market. And roughly speaking, it works on a time lag. By the time they do some monetary policy, it's about 15 to 16 months before the full effect has got into the stock market. What that means is, even if the Fed weren't going to do anything more right now, there's still more to come. making it pretty well inevitable we will be in a recession early next year. And we're talking America here, and your economy is an awful lot better than in plenty of other places. Here in England, even though we're only just leaving summer, there are plenty of people who can't turn the cooker on and pay the rent at the same time. And this is long before we're in winter. And there aren't enough nurses and doctors because they weren't paid very well after the pandemic was over. So that when we get a return to winter diseases, the waiting list in hospitals is going to be terrible. And just about every union in all sorts of unions all want wage rises. And as our inflation rate is about 10%, if you offer them anything less than 10%, they think you're trying to cut their wage rises. So I'm afraid here in England, we're going to have a worse period than you are in America. And it's absolutely no doubt that in bits of England, we're in a recession now. And the overall economy will be in a recession by the end of the year. And the market is too high. On how high the market is, though, in my latest newsletter, there are two ways of getting a market down. One is the overall rating that the market can hold can be devalued. And essentially, that's what's happened. Plenty of markets in the setback, you know, they lost premium value. And then in the rally, they put some of that back on again. However, if we're now going into a recession, in that period, the earnings themselves will decline. And that bit is not in any market discounted properly. And then, of course, there are lots of very good commentators, many of them American, that I like following, and all with very good names. And Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger, and then Ray Dalio and Jeremy Grantham. I mean, all of these, more or less with one voice, are saying to people, look, guys, don't try doing anything clever here. You're going to lose a lot of money if you're not very careful. You need to be very, very cautious indeed. I understand that Jamie Dimon is calling in some of the really, really big clients and suggesting to them that chances of a soft landing are of Mickey Mouse proportions, and that we should take on board we're going to have a recession, and anything other than really quite a hard, bumpy landing should be dismissed as a likely outcome. So, and it's global. It's very difficult to blame politicians in a particular country, but because it's a global phenomenon. I mean, even the parts of the world where China was growing like crazy, it's slowing right down now. And of course, their demographic, there are a lot too many old people there. So China isn't at the moment capable of being the great dynamo that it's been in the past. However, in my work, the only market that in the rally came up and got itself into the top category where I'm allowed to buy it, it wasn't America, it was India. The Indian economy is growing at between 7 and 8%, which these days is a pretty good number. It's just overtaken Great Britain as being the fifth biggest economy in the world. And only a couple of years ago, it was the 11th biggest. So it's doing pretty well. And of course, it's got fabulous demographics. And the final thing is, of course, it imports oil and gas. It has to. And unfortunately, what this makes the political situation really unstable, because we've now got a war with Russia, and Ms. Pelosi would quite like a war with China or something along those lines. And what you've got is China and India are both buying oil and gas from Russia. And this was actually written about 100 years ago by Mr. Mackinder. He pointed out that if that part of the world all links up, and they now are linked, anyone in the Western world can forget it, because that's simply not big enough or important enough. I'm close to saying the situation is, in my opinion, horrendously bearish. So certainly in my work, the two strongest assets that I'm owning are in fact commodity related. We tend to do it with exchange traded funds. And all that's happened in the commodity space is the metals have slipped back a bit. They're not weak, but they're no longer in the top category. But energy and food prices And there are various ways of playing them. They're right up in the top category. So the call from the work I am looking at is commodities or real things are better than paper assets, and it's too soon to abandon them. The notion that inflation is about to peak and disappear away, my work says, not going to happen soon. And that stock markets are due to not only lose the 10% they've just had in the rally from mid-June, but go lower again. And that brings me to seasonality. If you have to name a season of the year when equities don't do well, it's from about now till late October. So if we actually had a sudden setback of 20%, maybe 25%, between now and late October, it would fit rather remarkably well with what my work is suggesting.
Robin, let me go back to energy and inflation, especially in your country right now. It's estimated because of energy, inflation could be 22%. Your new prime minister is talking about giving out $140 billion in subsidies to help pay for it. But that's not going to solve your energy crisis. It just perpetuates it.
I'm afraid we are in a mess over in this country. We really are in a mess.
Well, we have the same issues going on here in California, Robin, where, you know, we're supposed to be the leader on climate change. And yet, you know, they're asking people that have EVs not to charge them from 3 to 8. And that's only 12% of our car fleet. And we're shutting down power plants with the stupid idea that we're going to have wind and solar, which is intermittent and doesn't always work.
Yes, yes. No, I agree with you 100%. I've gone to a hybrid car, but then it's still got a proper engine. So it's not relying on plugging in anywhere. But I know there are some fabulously wealthy billionaires, real very famous ones with growth businesses. And I fully understand their stories. But they are in the, there's a lot of what we might call middle America, where what you might call normal Americans, they're not well off. They haven't had a wage rise for a long time. And they're going backwards, and they know that. I also, you know, I'm afraid when I see what people like Pelosi do, it fills me with horror. You don't want all the high-tech chips now come from one single factory right in Taiwan. So you send her off out there to be rude to the Chinese. I mean, it feels, I panic when I see things like that. I really don't want that to happen. And several of these great commentators, and I'm particularly with Ray Dalio, because he's explaining in his own language what led on from my work when I was always at HSBC. I used to use the Kondratiev model and call them Kondratiev waves, and he just calls it the long cycle. But we're talking the same subject here, and it's changing. And he is pointing out that, you know, we're not in normal times, and there's absolutely no case of the panic going back to normal times. And you mentioned global warming. A third of Pakistan is underwater. I mean, I knew the Indus Valley could flood, but nothing like this. It is horrendous what we've got here. So the notion that we've had the end of inflation, I simply don't buy it. And the assets I'm following are saying it isn't over yet. There's nowhere near over.
I agree with you, Robin. Given this, as you argue, commodities or owning commodities are better than paper, even though we've seen a pullback here, both in energy and in the metals. But, you know, I take a look at the way this government, our own government, is spending money, the way these subsidies are being done in Europe in the policies. I can't help but see this inflationary cycle continuing.
I am with you. I'm really with you. I do think that there are, in senior levels, there are not too many people who get it properly. I do think in that, you know, Rishi is very intelligent and he did get it. But he was part of Johnson's government and he wasn't able to do all of the things. And now we've got someone who, she doesn't know what she's doing. I mean, if you'd asked her a month ago what she's doing today, wasn't a plan of hers at all. She's faffing around, basically, trying to do things that will make the public happy for a bit. But if you don't switch their electricity on and get us some doctors, because the waiting list and all these things, they're real problems and they need to be solved now. And she hasn't got the ability to do this. And I do feel that the world is unstable. In fact, looking back over my long career, the last time around that I was really as worried as I am now was from 1972 to 1974. At that stage, that bear market jolly nearly bankrupted me. I just survived it, but it came very, very, very close. And ever since then, we've had bull and bear markets, and I've been through them all. But what I'm looking at now does not fill me with great confidence that it's all wonderful. The good thing is, as I do understand, if you've got assets, a well-diversified portfolio of assets, inflation puts your value up because all of those assets will be inflated upwards. So your main problem is, have you got enough cash flow to stand volatile living expenses whilst that happens? And the people that do have that, they're just going to sit back. There'll be some chaos and the inflation will make them even richer. I can see that. And, you know, jolly good luck to be that. But an awful lot of people are not in that position. They're already living hand to mouth. Scraping by and going to food banks, and it's really quite bad here in London. And you know, London's a wealthy city, but I shouldn't see people going to food banks. But I see that now, and it's not good. So I do feel filled with caution. But funnily enough, in my ranking table of assets, there's cash in there. Cash is not very weak, but it isn't in the strongest category. So my work is not saying you've got to sell everything and sit on a pile of cash. That would only work if we happen to know there would be a crash next month. Well, there might be, but it isn't signaled as such. So, and the other thing is, I've even got inverse equities in there. So if he was absolutely right to be short the market, that asset would rise into the top category and we'd buy it and we'd effectively be short the market. And the work is not telling me to do that. What it is saying is hold on to the portfolio of mainly commodities, which has done us jolly well all along anyway. And just because the volatility in metal prices has dropped them back a little bit, it doesn't change the major story. I do think it's true to say that commodities generally are more volatile than stocks. So my work is saying we're going to have to live holding some more volatile assets. And of course, in the very short run, you can look suddenly, you know, as though you've done the wrong thing for a bit. Volatility does that. But the work is fairly strong to stay long at commodities. Food, very important. And probably energy, very important. And actually, I don't think metals are going to disappear at all, but they're just volatile.
All right. Well, listen, Robin, as we close here, if our listeners would like to follow the work that you do, tell them how they can do so.
The newsletter I write, I've moved it to a more convenient website. So the website is called Byte Tree. So byte-tree.com. When you go there, on that, there's a bit that says find AAA. That's my newsletters, Adaptive Asset Allocation. So you go to bytetree.com and you can find the newsletter called AAA. And at the moment, I've made it free. So anyone that does that now will get it for nothing. It won't be free forever, but it is free at the moment. And I've just moved over to this new website very recently.
All right. Well, listen, all the best to you and try to stay warm this winter there.
Thank you very much. Okay.
In 2021, when times were quote unquote good, the Fed was easy and interest rates were 0%, there was a 20 multiple on the market. And that's how we got to 4,800 in the S&P 500. Now, as interest rates have risen, that market multiple has come down. And here's why. If money is more expensive and the economy is likely to slow, then I as an investor will inherently get more defensive. I'm not going to be willing to pay 20 times earnings. Perhaps I'm only willing to pay 17 times earnings. Or if I'm worried about a recession, I'm only willing to pay 15 times earnings. And basically what we're looking at right now is there is a recession possibility. The Fed has raised rates substantially. We have quantitative tightening that is going to go full bore as we speak. And so in that environment, the more the Fed hikes rates, the lower the multiple goes.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, if there's any good news for consumers, is gasoline prices have been coming down at the pump. But will they stay that way, and what will happen this coming winter? Well, let's find out. Joining us on the program is Robert Rapier. Robert, let's begin with the oil and natural gas markets. It's hard to believe that natural gas was a little over $3 a year ago, got to as high as almost $10. It's in the low eights now. And gasoline is just slightly below 90, but we're in backwardation. Explain what that means for our listeners.
So this can all be traced back to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. I mean, that really is what has been the major factor upsetting the markets this year. So, you know, Russia supplies a lot of natural gas into Europe, and they supplied a lot of finished products in the U.S. And when Europe, whichever way it went, Russia decided they're not going to supply Europe anymore. Europe decided they're not going to take Russia's gas. And then the U.S. decided we're not going to take Russia's finished products. That's caused prices in all those markets to shoot up higher. And they're just now starting to settle down. And so backwardation just means that the current price is higher than the price in the futures market. And that means that the expectation is that demand and supply will continue to come in balance, and the price will continue to drift down. That's the belief. And that's where things have been headed. You know, that's probably going to happen, especially, you know, we're exiting high demand season now, although we're entering high demand season for natural gas. We're just now about to enter that season. But I think price is going to continue to settle down. But, you know, the two big wild cards in the market are always OPEC and Saudi Arabia. And OPEC pretty much snubbed President Biden's request that they pump more oil. They actually announced, I think, this week that they're going to make some cuts. I don't think they want to do anything to do him any favors. So I don't look for anything to be coming out of OPEC or Saudi Arabia to help out here.
Robert, what happens? The president has been draining our strategic petroleum reserves. I think we're going to get down to about a third by the time we get to the end of October, but then it stops. So they're taking him down prior to the election. What happens after the election when we're no longer draining the strategic petroleum reserve? What happens, and especially as we head into the winter months?
Right. I was just looking at this yesterday, and we're down about a couple hundred million barrels on the strategic petroleum reserve, down to levels last seen in the 80s. And this has been a major factor in the U.S. I mean, so the U.S. production is still not back up to its previous highs. We are up about 600,000 barrels a day over the previous year. But if you add the production to what's coming out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, there's a lot of oil hitting the markets in the U.S., and that's helped moderate prices. But as you say, this is not sustainable. We're draining a reserve that is supposed to be there in case, you know, we go to war and our oil supplies get shut off. Right now, they're basically playing Russian roulette here. If they'll probably get away with it. If you can drain the Strategic Petroleum Reserve and not have any, you know, call on that oil, then you can maybe get away with it. And it's politically, I mean, I think this is the most blatant political usage of the SPR that's ever been done, although all presidents do it. But this is a tremendous drawdown. And so after the election, you're in a situation where, okay, we're more vulnerable now to losing oil supplies. And if we did lose oil supplies, this will be looked upon as one of the worst decisions President Biden made. And historically, they'll look back and say that this was a disaster. If we don't, you know, he may not refill it. He may refill it. If supply continues to come online, then maybe it's okay. We're going into low demand season. But we are going to see, you know, some of the quote unquote supply that's been hitting the market is going to come off when those drawdowns stop. And the hope was always that production would catch up and demand would be lower. So, you know, what's really significant is what's going to happen in the spring when demand starts to pick back up and we're not draining the Strategic Petroleum Reserve anymore. You know, what happens to prices then?
Well, the Wall Street Journal just featured an article today talking about the government land leases for oil. And the Biden administration has only issued 0.13 leases compared to millions by previous presidents. So he's following through on his campaign promise to shut down the industry. But I'm not sure he's going to be able to get away with that. I mean, Robert, we still need jet fuel to get a plane in the air. You still need diesel to run trucks and boats, and we're still running gasoline for the majority of the cars in this country.
Right. I mean, you're gonna need. I mean, we have a system that's based on oil and gas, and over time that may change. But you know, if you try to phase that out too quickly, that's always been my argument about trying to block pipelines and block projects. If you don't have the supply when the supply is called upon, that's when you see skyrocketing prices. And, you know, that's what we've had. We've had very unfavorable conditions for refiners. So we've seen some refineries shut down. And that was prior to Russia's invasion, because when Russia invaded, the margins blew out. I mean, you had very, very high margins on finished products then. And there was the question was, why are we shutting down refineries then? Well, because the outlook is not good. And so they're not looking at just right now, you know, what are our margins right now? They're looking at what's it going to look like over the next 10 years, because we're not going to make a $1 billion investment if we don't think it's going to pay out over time. And so you create these unfavorable conditions and this unfavorable outlook. But if the demand is still there, and the demand was really there when we stopped importing Russian finished products, that we, you know, suddenly there's a great demand on the refineries that they can't meet. And so we see skyrocketing prices. And that's what happens when you create an unfavorable environment, shut down projects, but you don't curtail demand at the same time or fast enough.
Robert, let's talk about where we're moving. And my own state of California is a good example. We're sort of leading this green wave. We passed several laws. In 2030, you won't be able to drive a diesel truck in the state. 2035, you won't be able to buy a combustion engine. So we want to shift over to EVs, which we have the weather for it, but we don't have the grid for it, because right now we're going through a heat wave. And the governor has asked people that have EVs not to charge them between 3 o'clock and 8 o'clock. What the hell are we going to do when everybody in this state has an EV and we're shifting to unreliable sources of electricity?
Yeah, it's definitely a warning that the government should heed. I mean, if you can't meet electricity demand now and you're going to shift that to something much higher, you better make sure the grid can handle that. And I know they're upgrading the grid and doing things with the grid, but again, if you get to some point in the future where you've incentivized all these electric vehicles and you can't handle that demand, you're going to see more and more blackouts. And, you know, that's something the government has to be conscious of. And that's what happens when you try to phase out fossil fuels too quickly and shift to renewables too quickly. If the demand for fossil fuels is still there and the supply is not there, you're going to have the situation that you have now. And the same with shutting down nuclear plants. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to shut down nuclear plants if you have an electricity problem, unless it's an inherently unsafe plant for some reason. Germany shutting down nuclear plants. I mean, they had perfectly safe nuclear plants over there, and they're shutting those down, and now they're losing Russian gas. So, they're creating some problems there that don't have to be.
Yeah, that's the thing. We've seen the problems with Europe. There was a story on the Friday news where they were showing people outside of Berlin cutting down a forest and trees to have wood to burn to stay warm this winter. So you would think, Robert, when you're seeing the mishaps of ESG policies, whether it's Sri Lanka, the Netherlands, Germany, and even England, where they're talking about subsidizing $150 billion to keep fuel costs capped for Brits, you would think they would learn from that, maybe take a pause, because things like wind and solar don't work in a lot of land masses around the globe. EVs don't work that well in cold climate. You would think we'd take a step back. And I don't understand why the environmentalists are so against nuclear power. We've never lost a life from nuclear power in this country that I'm aware of.
Yeah, I mean, unless it was construction. I mean, there may have been something construction during a plant. I could see that happening. But yeah, you're right. There's not been, the Three Mile Island was the closest we got. That was a close call. We've made plants safer and safer since then. We've not had anything remotely like that. Current designs are designed, there are designs available now. And I just spoke to, someone high up in the nuclear agency. I'm going to have a Forbes article on that within the next week or so. And she told me, the current designs are such that if something goes wrong, the operator should be able to walk away from the plant and it will shut down in a safe state. And, that's the goal. Honestly, we can't have a Fukushima or a Chernobyl every 20 years. I mean, nuclear can't do that. But if you can ensure that you've got a safe design that you can walk away from and that you're not going to have any sort of accidents, there is nothing safer out there than nuclear power. And, no carbon emissions. And I get in arguments with people all the time. They say, well, solar is cheaper. Well, it could be. I mean, it may be cheaper, but it doesn't matter if it can't supply all the power. And so that's the issue. You can replace a coal-fired power plant with a nuclear plant in China. You can't replace a coal-fired power plant with a solar farm. I mean, the amount of land it would take to do that is just that those solar installations in China happen over very, very large areas, and they're much smaller installations than, one of those big coal-fired power plants. So it's not really comparing apples and apples.
And Robert, what about something called EROI, which is energy return on investment? It is obviously, I think I read it's like 30-1 for fossil fuels. It's 5-10 for solar and wind. And not to mention, Robert, the amount of land that is necessary to put up a wind or solar farm compared to, let's say, a nuclear plant, which is more efficient.
Right. And the footprint difference. I mean, if you looked at a footprint of a nuclear plant versus the footprint of a similar solar farm to output the same amount, it'd be enormously, enormously greater. I mean, I was looking at those footprint numbers the other day, and it's tremendous how much difference there is. So, yeah, the energy return on energy invested, just, you wouldn't invest, one BTU of oil to get a BTU of oil back. That doesn't make any sense. You might invest a BTU worth of oil to get, 20 BTUs back. And that's the, that's the energy return on energy invested. Where people get messed up, though, you might invest a BTU of coal to get a BTU of oil back. I mean, that's a low EROI, but it's an investment that you might make. So, there is that aspect of EROI. I tell people, be careful using that because, unless you're comparing like forms of energy, it can give you some misleading results.
The thing that really strikes me here, if you take a look at what we're doing with energy-wise, we've seen it, Robert, after 2014 when the price of oil dropped down into the lower levels, companies stopped investing. Then ESG came in, whether it's the European Union asking Royal Dutch to scale back on its fossil fuel investments, or its people joining the board of Exxon, or urging Chevron to ditch its oil assets. I mean, last year they were dragging them before Congress, telling them to ditch their assets. And this year they're dragging them before Congress, asking them to produce more. So it's a very unstable market if you're in the energy business, because one day they want you to do something, the next day they don't.
Right. I mean, it's always been that way, though. The politicians make certain demands. There will be a consequence. And the consequence this year is record profits for the oil and gas companies. I mean, there are shortages created by policy, and those shortages result in skyrocketing prices. And then what does the government do? They go in and they try to subsidize the costs for consumers. So the government, who says we need less carbon emissions, when you go then and release oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve in an effort to control prices, so you're saying we're not going to curb demand by price. And that's honestly, that's what they want to do. They want to reduce carbon emissions, but they can't stand the political fallout of high prices. So they go and they tap the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. It's dysfunctional, but it's politics. They can't stay in office if, you know, gas prices are $4 and $5 a gallon. But that is incompatible with their desire to, you know, lower carbon emissions. So they go out and incentivize consumers to burn more oil and gas by making the price cheaper. And that just contradicts what their ultimate goal is on carbon emissions.
Yeah. I mean, giving somebody more money to spend, that's not going to bring the cost down. You know, what we really need to do, you know, Robert, I'm really surprised that we're going to just strictly EVs. What makes a lot of sense in this transition period that they're talking about is to go more to hybrids. Like, for example, I recently took a trip. I drove from San Diego to Seattle, took us 2 days. And Robert, I was able to pull into a gas station, fill my car up, 5 minutes back on the road. If you're driving an EV, it's not 5 minutes at the gas station, you're back on the road, it's 45 minutes charging your battery.
Right. And we don't have the infrastructure yet to allow that with great convenience to travel, you know, across the country. And EVs, there will be a different sort of, mindset. Because you're right. You know, if I'm going cross country, I can stop in 5 minutes, I'm filled up and I'm back on the road. And, it's a different sort of mindset. It's a longer trip then, because you've got to have more time for charging. And I agree with you. Hybrids make a lot of sense. If I'm the government, I don't like mandates. What I would do is I wouldn't say, combustion engines are outlawed. I would offer incentives to shift people in that direction, because if you offer incentives and people aren't shifting in that direction, there's a reason for that. There's an economic reason for that. But when you just mandate, when you say, hey, we're going to stop selling combustion engines, it'd be like saying, hey, we're going to stop selling oil tomorrow. What would happen? Well, you would. The price to get gasoline would skyrocket, because people would be getting it wherever they could on the black market or wherever. I mean, you create these problems when you have these mandates, and when you say, you cannot buy a combustion engine anymore. You create all kinds of market disruptions then that, if you offered incentives instead, that would be a whole lot better, because you can say, OK, well, the incentive wasn't enough. Why wasn't it enough? Let's try to understand this a little bit better. Why people aren't embracing this. Maybe that is not enough of an offset for them. So we maybe need to go back and look at this.
So Robert, as you view the market right now, right now we're in the shoulder months of the year. Weather's nice. Summer driving season is over. So energy prices should come down a bit here in this soft part of the year. But then we head into the winter and we don't know what that winter is going to look like. What would you be doing as an investor? Because, I mean, some of the best dividends and lowest price earnings ratios are in the energy sector.
Right. So I screen energy companies every week, and I've got a couple of different kinds of screens. One is looks at undervalued, low volatility, and nice dividends. And this week I looked, and ExxonMobil popped up near the top of the list. I've got BP near the top of that list. I've got Suncor, which popped up on the list for the first time in a long time. And I guess it's probably gotten some upgrades. Suncor, it's a Canadian company. It hasn't been on my list lately. So that's a new company that I actually made a recommendation to buy that for subscribers of my newsletter today, because I think Suncor looks pretty undervalued, and it's got a nice risk to reward proposition there. And then finally, Eni, the European oil company. That's the Italian company. I think that looks pretty undervalued. There are some other companies that are very highly ranked, but they're a little more volatile. You know, like ConocoPhillips, it's still ranks near the top of the list. Some of the MLPs, if you're if you are okay in the MLP space, Enterprise Products Partners, which I own myself and have for a long time, it's near the top of the list. You can't get much better than a 7%+ yielder that has sustainable cash flow year after year after year. But that's what Enterprise Products is.
All right. Well, listen, Robert, as we close, you're a prolific writer. You write on several spots. Tell our listeners how they could read and find out more about you.
So, yeah, I have a column usually once a week on Forbes. It covers the entire energy sector. And then for Investing Daily, I have a couple of subscription columns, one covering income investments. It's called Utility Forecaster, but it covers all of sort of the income sector. And then I've got one called Income Accelerator, which is a covered call and cash covered put service. We cover all the sectors in the S&P 500.
All right. Well, listen, Robert, as always, pleasure having you on the program. Come back and talk to us again.
Welcome, everyone, to today's Big Picture. Today, we're going to discuss how we're seeing all the wrong policies in place and why the energy crisis that is currently underway will worsen. Now, Jim, I want to harken back to May of 2020. This was just, 2 to 3 months after we saw negative oil prices momentarily. And you had predicted that we would likely see an energy crisis unfold based on the disruption that we were looking at. And of course, here we are, the unfolding of an energy crisis, not just here in the U.S., but also in Europe. So let's talk about what you're looking at in terms of why you think the energy crisis that you called for and you forecasted is actually going to worsen.
Well, Chris, all we have to do is just take a look at politicians are making matters worse with their policies. And, you know, we all read about the stories of ESG and how it's impacting markets. It's impacting oil companies. One example we've all seen recently is Indonesia. They made their farmers go to organic farming. The next thing they know, rice prices are up 50%. They had to import rice because of lack of food. You go to Denmark, they're doing the same thing. They're denying nitrogen fertilizer for their farmers. And it's estimated that maybe 1 out of 3 farms will fail in Denmark. We're seeing it play out in Germany, where they shut down their nukes and nat gas plants. It's funny, the irony out of this for climate change. Now they're going back and firing up their coal-fired plants. And then also, Chris, you and I are dealing with this in California, where California shut down our San Onofre. We had 2 nuclear power plants. We shut down the first close to us, which is San Onofre. They're debating on whether they're going to shut down the second one, but we shut down nat gas and coal plants. And this week, because of the heat wave, we were on stage 3 alerts for rolling blackouts. I think it was up in Silicon Valley, 37,000 people lost their power. We are told you got to turn your thermostat up to 78 if you have an EV. This is the ironic thing. If you have an EV, the governor doesn't want you charging it from 3 to 8. And Chris, in California, we hold about 40% of the nation's EVs because EVs work great in warm weather. They don't work well in cold weather. So we have 40% of the nation's EVs. That represents roughly about 12% of all cars in California. So if we can't charge cars now with the grid that we have and still one nuclear plant operating, what the hell are we going to do when we're up to 80, 90% EVs and we're going to shut down most of our power plants and replace them with wind and solar, which doesn't work that well because it's intermittent, number one. Number two, it's more costly. Number three, it's not environmental friendly. So you add it all up, and it's why we're seeing what we're seeing, whether you're looking at Europe, Germany, Robin Griffith, we were talking to him, what's going on with England. And so there's nothing the politicians are doing that are going to make this any better. In fact, and many in the U.S. think, oh, we're better off because, you know, we produce a lot of our own energy. But I got a warning, folks, the environmental mandates that are being put in place in California are going to be adopted by 17 other states. So California kind of leads the way with doing anything green. So as crazy as California is, it may be coming to your state shortly.
Well, yeah, and as we know, Europe has really paved the way and been the leader in ESG policies. A lot of that has come out of Europe, out of the UK, and Germany being in the lead, the most aggressive in its pursuit of both ESG and renewable energy technology for its own economy, making themselves completely dependent upon Russia for oil and gas, since they decided, hey, we're going to turn off our nuclear power plants, we're not going to invest in domestic production, and we're just going to import that from Russia and let them deal with the environmental concerns that come from that. And California is close behind, if right, not in the mix of being as aggressive in their pursuit.
Yeah. In fact, when we did the interview with the folks at Doomberg, they were basically saying that basically what Newsom was doing to California was the same thing that Merkel did to Germany. But Chris, it's not just the U.S. It's a global response. I mean, one of the silliest things that we've done is Janet Yellen called for the G7 to put a price cap on the price of Russian oil. Well, how do you put a price cap on something you don't own? That's number one. Secondly, you saw the Russian response. They were shutting down Nord Stream 1 for maintenance. After that was announced, well, now it's just shut down. So, sorry, Europe, no nat gas. Brussels is enacting bureaucratic controls that will give it more power over energy. And in Europe, they're facing bankruptcies to the tunes of trillions of dollars of energy companies and utilities. And if they don't bail them out, Chris, they're going to end up bailing out the banks. And it's one reason why you're seeing dollar strength right now is if you take a look at the issues in Europe, which are going to be much worse, they're worse than they are here, what they're going on in Asia, where are you going to put money? I mean, don't forget, up until about a year ago, interest rates in Europe were actually negative. So imagine you're a company like Apple, you're sitting on $250 billion in cash. Where are you going to put it? You can't put it in a bank. So that leaves the most largest and liquid market in the globe, which is the U.S. market. And that's the main reason why you're seeing the dollar rise to levels you've never seen. And some people are saying, well, that's impacting commodities. Well, if commodities are priced in dollars, it's cheaper for us, but it's not cheaper for elsewhere in the world. So if you're a European, you've got the euro now below the dollar. You got the Japanese yen approaching 150. So just imagine what you're having to pay for oil and food if you're living elsewhere in the world. And it doesn't stop with that, because these ESG policies, I talked about Indonesia, talked about Denmark, and we talked about Germany. But it's also taking place here, where basically you have big investment banks, whether it's Vanguard or BlackRock, are basically pulling money, not putting money in the sector. The sector, at least the energy sector, is capital starved. And so, I mean, if you're Exxon, Chevron, you're going to be okay. But if you are a smaller company, good luck trying to get financing. In fact, some are saying forbidding or urging banks not to lend to the energy sector. And of course, Biden is following through with what he talked about, that he was going to end fossil fuels. Well, the Wall Street Journal just did an article this week, and out of all the presidents since World War II, Biden has approved the fewest amount of leases. Normally, there are 4 to 5 million leases that have been approved by each president. I think Biden has approved like 0.013 leases. I mean, it's starving the sector. And then, of course, with this last bill that they just passed, there are going to be energy taxes. And the sad thing about this is promoting wind and solar, which is not going to work. As we talked about with Peter Zeihan, he wrote in his recent book, wind and solar doesn't work on about 2/3 of the world's landmass. And yet we keep promoting it. It's less environmentally friendly, contrary to what you thought. And I wonder, Chris, we've had Michael Schellenberger on, who's an environmentalist, and he had a quote of just what wind and solar, how costly it is in terms of its footprint, its environmental impact, and its cost.
Yeah, so Michael Schellenberger recently said that many think we will subsidize our ways to renewables, and he says that we won't because solar and wind power, they're too dilute. They're not energy dense enough. Solar wind projects need around 300 times more land, 300% more copper, and 700% more rare earths than fossil fuels, making them prohibitively expensive. So obviously, if you think about the amount of mining that is needed, strip mining in many cases, to get all that copper, rare earths require strip mining. So you are having to excavate large amounts of earth just to get all of those critical minerals that we would need for producing solar, for wind. And of course, there's a whole bunch of environmental impacts, which Michael has pointed out. If you do all-in costs, if you include the mining, if you include the industrial processing of all these metals to get them refined down to something that you need and then put into the solar panels, all of a sudden you're looking at something that is way, way less efficient than what you'd get from nuclear, from oil and gas, and from traditional fossil fuels.
Yeah, that was what, when we had Professor Hall on the show two or three weeks ago, he was the one that came up with the concept, energy return on investment. And what we're doing is we're going from a 30-to-1 return on investment, meaning one input of energy in the fossil fuel sector produces 30 units of energy. When you go to wind and solar, you're going from 30-to-1 down to 10 to 5-to-1. So it's less efficient. But the most important thing is the lack of critical thinking. Number one, EVs don't do as well in cold weather. So there's number one. Number two, solar and wind does not work in a lot of places, especially solar does not work in cold weather climates up north, as we see. And you're talking about something that isn't predictable. It isn't consistent like you would get from a nat gas plant or what you would get from a nuclear powered plant. And as many people who have done the critical thinking have said, you cannot have green without nuclear. And yet the United States has 54 nuclear plants. China has 47. China is building 11. We're building 2, but we're retiring 6. So within the next couple of years, we're going to have fewer nuclear plants at the same time that we're going green. So there's just not a lot of thinking. It's just like, hey, it's great. You get up there and you say, hey, I'm affecting climate change. And there's no critical thinking there because you're exempting China and India, basically half the world, from the Paris Climate Accords. So there's not a follow through of, like Newsom gave a speech and he said, hey, I've solved the problem. We're going to do windmills. Good luck trying to put windmills offshore. Can you imagine the folks in Malibu or Santa Barbara or places like that approving windmills offshore? I doubt it.
I think a lot of the ugly facts behind pursuing renewable energy willy-nilly and seeing it as so environmentally friendly without recognizing the full all-in costs of it were easy to do because if we think about solar panels, for example, and this came out probably about a few years ago was when this information started to be released or at least become more well-known, was that, you know, the majority of the solar panels that we use here in the U.S. are produced in China. And so if you're looking at, you know, energy production, if you're looking at the efficiency of a solar panel versus fossil fuels, you're going to say, oh, yeah, no, there's no carbon tied to those at all. That's if you ignore the fact that they're created in China using coal. So, you know, there's all these hidden facts that, you know, you just conveniently sweep under the rug to frame this narrative that, you know, these renewable energy technologies, ESG policies, they're all benefit and no cost. And yet we're starting to realize the costs are actually a lot bigger than perhaps people are willing to admit on the other side.
Well, it's not just that. I mean, if you think about rare earth minerals, China has a lock on rare earth minerals. So once again, just as we're seeing the supply chain problems that resulted with the lockdowns and the pandemic, now we're relying on all the key materials and parts for green from China. So, you know, how's that going to work out? Like I said, lack of critical thinking. speaking. But I think one of the biggest things we're also seeing, all of this culminating in what we've seen, the lowest inventories of oil, natural gas, copper. I mean, one of the main reasons you're seeing we expected oil prices to soften here as we head into the shoulder months, which we're in now, September and October, summer driving season's over. Refineries are going to be switching over to heating fuels and things that we need for the winter months. And we're at the lowest levels that I've seen, probably well below the five-year average. And the only thing that has kind of suppressed this to some degree is the president is drained. We're going to be down to only about a third left of our strategic petroleum reserves, which leaves us, Chris, very vulnerable because we're still in the hurricane season. So if we get hit by a hurricane in the Gulf that shuts down a lot of those offshore platforms, as we've seen repeatedly over the last couple of decades, or God forbid, another conflict erupts in the Middle East or elsewhere, it's going to leave the country very vulnerable. It's probably one of the worst decisions I think the Biden administration has made, is to drain this for political purposes prior to the election. But nonetheless, it is. But Chris, we're seeing a bit of a backlash against ESG, for example, against BlackRock and Vanguard. Several attorney generals, I think it's around 17 states now, are filing suits against them. And it's not just that. It's falling production from existing oil wells. We've highlighted, and I've written about this, that the majority of our oil comes from about 60 oil fields that were discovered probably 50 to 70 years ago. One of them, the biggest, Garwar, is probably almost getting to the point running on empty. It's one of the reasons we're waking up to the fact that the Saudis cannot produce what they say they can. It's long believed that anytime we had a spike in oil prices, we always looked to Saudi Arabia as the largest producer. And it was widely believed that they had anywhere from 2.5 to 3 million barrels of spare capacity. Turns out they don't. The realistic number is probably maybe 500,000 barrels. And even when they produced 10 million barrels of oil, it wasn't all their oil. It was relabeled as it came out of inventory, or it was relabeled Iraqi oil. So, and we saw that this summer when Biden went to G7, he was heading off to Saudi Arabia to get them to produce more, even though he doesn't want us to produce it. And basically, Macron said, hey, they can't. You know, maybe you might be able to get 150 out of OPEC, but that's it. So everybody is now questioning the reserves, something the late Matt Simmons talked about when he wrote his book back in 2005, Twilight in the Desert. And so Matt was looking at this very closely, and I was fortunate enough to be a friend of Matt's, and he turned a lot of his research papers over to me. And that's where I learned a lot about energy. I learned it through Matt Simmons. And all those research papers culminated in his book, Twilight in the Desert. But prices get much lower than, let's say, $80 a barrel. I think, Chris, you're going to see OPEC defend it. They announced a 100,000 barrel cut on Monday, which is much at this point. But they basically have signaled to the market, hey, we might not be able to raise production, but we are certainly capable of cutting production.
And you brought up a good point there, Jim, just saying how we're seeing declining production globally with these large oil wells that we're not finding nearly as often as we did in the past. Along those lines, I mean, you have argued, we've argued on the show steadily, that for that reason, we do need to be thinking about transitioning to other sources of energy and supplementing our fossil fuel consumption with other sources, nuclear in particular being one, but also renewable energy as well. However, we need to do it in a very common sense fashion that's dictated by economics, not one that's just implemented in a rushed fashion as we're seeing today that, for example, makes us overly dependent on one country or one area for the processing of all these minerals or the production of them. And we need to do it in a strategic and common sense manner. So that's the main message that we've been getting across. Yes, we do need to transition to other sources of energy. We should be doing this. This is just obvious, but we need to do it in such a way that makes sense for everyone. And particularly, I mean, we don't want to see what we see today with the energy crisis right now in Europe, where they're paying I mean, 5 to 7 times in some cases, prices that they were paying just a year ago. We don't want to see that. We don't want to see consumers seeing 100%, 200% or more increases in their electricity bills and their food bills and all of the things that are happening because, you know, we're going to shut down the use of fertilizers or we're going to curtail the use of fossil fuels, right? That's what we don't want to see.
No. And Chris, you know, I've been a big believer in peak oil, as was Matt Simmons. He passed away prior to seeing fracking and horizontal drilling. But in my mind, all that did was delayed its arrival. So are we at peak oil? I believe we're getting close to it, which was one of the big reasons why we need to make this transition. We used to interview Robert Hirsch, and he wrote extensively about peak oil. And he said, the best thing you could do for it is start preparing for it 2 decades in advance. The next best would be 10 years, but you're still going to run into difficulties and higher prices. The worst thing is not doing anything. So we are doing something by, you know, whether you're putting up windmills or solar, but that's not going to do it. Like so many have said, whether it's Michael Schellenberger, he's talked about nuclear. A lot of the experts that we've talked to said, you are not going to do green without nuclear. And Chris, instead of EVs, we should be doing hybrids, because hybrids at least will get better gas mileage. So you take the Prius, for example, that gets 50 to 60. They operate in cold weather. And also would be a nice vehicle to get us through this transition that we're trying to make. Trying to dictate that it's all going to be EVs when they don't work in many places, and windmills and let's say solar that doesn't work, that doesn't make a lot of sense. So I'm trying to think the interview, it was done recently. And basically the gentleman was saying, if we don't pivot quick, what is happening to California is coming to the rest of the U.S. And this has broad implications for economic growth, Chris, because one of the problems that you have with economics, and this is what Charles Hall has written in his new book called Energy and the Wealth of Nations. He's talking about, you know, most economics is taught with supply and demand curves. The price goes up, you get more supply, you get less consumed, the price goes down, you get less supply, and more is consumed. Well, one of the problem with basic economics, it doesn't factor in energy, which is basically what Charles Hall was writing about in his books. So as energy prices go up, as we get less of it, as it becomes more expensive, I think what it's going to lead to is what you're seeing now, which is stagflation. So it'll be lower economic growth with rising inflation. And that's where we are right now.
You know, Jim, one thing that ties into this that I think is important part of this conversation when it comes to market implications is how we're seeing some of the problems that we see in Europe with their unfolding energy crisis, which is likely to get worse from here now that Russia has completely cut off their gas supplies to Europe through the Nord Stream pipeline. That was something that we just recently discussed. But the as this is leading to an energy crisis and to an economic crisis, and our guest that we spoke with this week thinks it's going to lead to not just a severe economic recession in Europe, but potentially a pretty significant financial crisis as well. There's a lot of capital that is fleeing Europe and elsewhere around the world that's flooding into the U.S. as a safe haven. And so the U.S. dollar has been pretty strong. There's a number of things that are happening here. Some nuance, key nuances that I know that you've been looking at. Do you mind sharing what you're seeing happening on the foreign exchange, you know, sort of currency route here when it comes to energy and capital flows?
Yeah, well, as you just mentioned, Chris, one of the reasons that you've seen such dollar strength, just look at Europe. Remember, a year ago, they had negative interest rates. So imagine loaning the government money and they charge you interest. So that's one reason. The rates are lower, although the ECB just raised interest rates 0.75 points. So they're kind of following the Fed's lead here. And things aren't much better in Asia. So we have the largest, most liquid market in the world. And still today, over 60% of most commodities are priced in dollars. So there's a dollar shortage. So people are scrambling for dollars right now. But this is kind of an artificial. It's not like the U.S. is doing very well. We're doing better when it comes to energy in some of the crises that you're seeing overseas. But give us a little time if we can continue these policies. But something else that they don't like is the U.S. is very big on sanctions. We use the dollar and we use our financial system to sanction and make it part of our foreign policy. Well, the Russians and the Chinese are trying to insulate themselves from those sanctions. So they're moving, they're accumulating large amounts of gold. Gulf state that just bought 14 tons of gold, the largest gold purchase they've made since the 1960s. So there's talk of a different gold exchange with the BRIC countries, which would be basically Brazil, Russia, India, and China, plus the Gulf states. They don't like the way the U.S. Precious metals market is manipulated. The best example, just take a look at the price of silver where it is today. Good luck trying to buy a silver eagle. You're probably going to pay an 80% premium and probably wait 6 weeks to get your eagles. So they're talking about setting up their own gold and precious metals exchange away from the U.S. So that's something to keep your eye on. Russia and China also are working on issuing a gold-backed currency. And so as you see, a lot of the things that Peter Zeihan talked about in his book, Deglobalization, which he predicted more scarcity, more food shortages, and you're going to see the emergence of currency blocks that will begin to rise and compete against the dollar. So one of the big stories we think for 2023 is going to be short the dollar. And we can see that coming because the dollar's strength as it is today isn't because the economic fundamentals are so strong in the United States. It's just we have the biggest, most liquid market. If you look at commodities, whether it's oil, gold, and silver, and foreign currencies, they're actually going up. The only place they're dropping is in the U.S.
And one other part to this that we should point out is when it comes to, as you said, you know, there's a potential gold exchange that could be building here between BRIC nations and the Gulf states, Russia and China also working behind the scenes. This just came out 2 days ago. We're speaking on Thursday, September 8th, but the headline that came out this week, which is pretty significant, is that China has now agreed to pay for Russian gas in rubles and yuan. It's a pretty significant development. This was something that Louis Gov discussed on our show last week about how behind the scenes, you know, we're seeing after U.S. and Western countries sanction Russia and kick them out of the SWIFT banking network, that Russia now, they now had to start working unilaterally with countries to sell their oil and gas in rubles. So China and Russia have now agreed that they're going to do that. So this is a significant development. This goes into, you know, what we've discussed for many years. All commodities have been priced in U.S. dollars, and U.S. dollars have been the reserve currency of payment for commodities. We're seeing an incremental shift away from that now, given the new geopolitical environment that we face. And so, Jim, what are you looking at for investment implications when it comes to the commodity space moving forward?
Well, Chris, we see, given the environment right now, we see scarcity, short supply in many commodities, whether it's copper, whether it's oil, whether it's key strategic minerals that we're using in this green transition. So number one, we own oil, and we also own commodities. We own the precious metals. And, you know, they haven't done that well, especially the stocks. But you know something? I'll talk about the industry here in a minute here. But one of the nice things about some of the commodity stocks is the dividend yields go from 4 to 12%. And so it was kind of one of the reasons, Chris, when I bought oil stocks in 2020, they didn't do anything for a whole year. But, you know, I was getting 6 to 8% in dividends. I was getting almost 80% of the long term return in the stock market just in cash flow. So a lot of these metal stocks, base metals, precious metals, energy stocks, and some of the food stocks are some of the best dividend payers that you can get out there. So at a time that you're only getting maybe 3.5% on a short-term treasury because longer-term treasuries pay less, you can get great dividends in the commodity space. So I'm 30% in commodities, and I intend to hold them because I see a decade of gains. And when these commodity cycles take off, the returns over the cycle are as high as 800%. I mean, think about, for example, in 2020, we began that year with gold at 250. And just recently this year, it hit over 2000. Think of where silver went all the way up to 50. And I think silver is going much higher. If there's one great undervalued asset right now, strategically, it's silver. And also the industry. I don't care if you're looking at Barrick, you're looking at Newmont, they've shed debt. Their cash flow has increased. They're buying back stock. Some of the best dividends I've gotten in the accounts that we manage have come from the resource sector. So when you can get 4 to 5% in dividends, Chris, and those dividends are going up even more, in some of the cases, these dividends have doubled just in the last 12 months. And so this is something I love, and I think you're going to see more of. So you're being paid a rate of return in actual cash that you can spend, use, invest while you wait for this to come around. Because as our friends at Gary and Rosenzweig have illustrated, in fact, I used one of their graphs in an article I wrote, and I'll probably use it again. It shows the commodity cycle over 100 years, and this is the lowest price that we've ever been in the last 100 years. And here's another one that will surprise you. What do you think was the best performing investment sector during the Great Depression from 1930 to 1940? Commodities. You made a lot of money in commodities in the Great Depression because, once again, the commodity cycle of investment had gone down. So we needed more commodities just as we have today as a result of the bear market that really began, well, with precious metals, it began in 2011. With oil, it began in 2014. So oil companies are investing probably half of what they should be investing to replace the barrels of oil that are going out the front door. So we love the commodity space. I own food, as I believe you will see food shortages. You're seeing it not just as a result of the Ukraine, but what Denmark is doing to its farmers, what Indonesia did to its farmers. And Chris, Peter Zion talked about food shortages as we go through deglobalization, because everything that you have known in your lifetime is going to change in this decade. Now, it's as Robin Griffith talked about, it's more volatile, but there's a reason for that. It's such a small space. If you take the largest mining companies in the world, BHP, Rio Tinto, Newmont, or let's say Barrick, you add their market cap, they don't even come close to that of Apple. So we're in 2008, mining and energy stocks represented 20% of the S&P. Today, they only represent 2%. The biggest sector within the S&P is technology. So the great thing about it is I love the cash flow and dividends these companies are producing. And if things go where I think they're going this decade, it'll be the best return on any sector you can invest in my personal opinion. That's why we're holding firm. And Chris, the nice thing is, while we're holding, we're getting paid to do it.
And just to be clear, when you're talking about investing in the commodity sector, that's not with the underlying commodities per se. Like, you're not talking about investing in the commodity futures market. You're talking more along the lines of best of breed, dividend paying stocks that have paid down their debt and producing these commodities.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I started out using the commodity ETFs. But then when I saw what was going on within the industry, I saw the new CEO at Barrick turning the company around, shedding debt, increasing dividends, and they have a couple mines coming on that are going to make them one of the largest copper producers in the world. So I'm looking strategically what was going on. And I said, boy, I've got to get in. And the nice thing I love, I love dividends. And I don't invest in companies that don't pay dividends or have a history of paying them, because then I get paid. And, you know, I learned that there was a book called Triumph of the Optimist that was written around the turn of the century by a bunch of professors out of London School of Economics. And they looked at 16 stock markets over the last 100 years. And, you know, you hear this figure that, you know, stocks produce 10% longer term. But people don't realize half of that return comes from dividends. And that's why I'm a big believer in dividends, because otherwise, if you don't get any dividends, you just hope and cross your fingers the stock you bought is going to go up in value. And also, high dividend stocks tend to hold up better in a market downturn. So I'm a great believer, just like Warren Buffett. And by the way, Warren Buffett, outside of Apple, Buffett's second largest holdings are in energy. He owns almost 20% of Occidental Petroleum. I think he has close to 30 million shares of Chevron. And so most people don't realize that Buffett is very big on energy. He owns the utility for the state of Nevada. So Buffett is a big believer in energy.
Obviously, ESG policies and pressure haven't affected him yet in terms of his investing style.
Nope, never have. He's too smart for that.
All right. Well, Jim, I want to close today's show since you know, we are talking about here a pretty heavy subject, that the energy crisis is going to continue, likely get worse, given that we're implementing a lot of the wrong policies here. So I want to close with just a little bit of humor. As we're talking about, you know, political miscalculations and inflation and a number of these things that are having economic repercussions that all of us are feeling, I want to ask a question to you then. What's the difference between California and the Titanic?
I have no idea, unless we're going to sink in the ocean.
The Titanic had its lights on when it sank.
Okay.
here's one more. Here's a headline. This is from the Babylon Bee. It's a satirical website. But here's a headline they put out. Governor Gavin Newsom promises there will be enough electricity for all Californians after everyone moves to Florida.
Well, that's certainly true. You know, it's amazing because I would say about a third of my clients that are retiring are leaving California. They're going to Arizona, Nevada. A couple have gone to Florida, Texas, places where basically things are run better and there's less in taxes, less crowd, less crime, all kinds of things. So it used to be the Golden State, but not anymore. But it's the only place I know of, Chris, that I could go sailing all year around. I can go sailing in December. In fact, we went last year. The weather was beautiful in the month of December. So it's hard to give that up in the California beaches.
Well, Jim, you and I and Financial Sense Wealth Management, we are located in a very special part of California that almost everyone I talk to wishes they could move to, and that's called San Diego.
Yeah. You know, we used to come over. I grew up in Arizona. We used to come over here during spring break or during the summers for vacation. And I just loved it when we got over here in the beaches, the sea and the bay and everything about it. I never thought I'd be lucky enough one day to come here and move and start a business, which I did in 1982. And looking back, I don't regret it. I mean, I just absolutely love the weather. I'm an outdoor person, so I love being outdoors. And you can do that in San Diego, in California, especially along the coast because of the weather. So, in fact, I think I read that San Diego has the best. It's the number one city in the world for weather. And there's something to say for that.
You know, with that said, as I mentioned, Financial Sense Wealth Management, we're located here in San Diego, but we serve clients all over the U.S. And Financial Sense Wealth Management has been ranked as one of the top registered investment advisors in the U.S. by the Financial Times. So, if you'd like to get in touch with us to speak with any of our financial planners or asset managers to talk about how we can assist you in your financial planning needs, feel free to give us a call at 888-486-3939, or you can go to our website, financialsense.com, and hit where it says contact us.
In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Sheridan and myself, we want to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.